KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Pell Grants send thousands of lower-income students to college each year across the country. However, proposed changes could lower that number drastically, often in the communities that need it most, like tribes. South Dakota Public Broadcasting C.J. Keene has more.
Proposed Trump administration changes could slash Pell Grant funding by as much as a quarter. In a tribal setting like the Pine Ridge Reservation, that represents well over 60% of students reliant on some amount of Pell Grant support. Oglala Lakota College President Don Frank says that would devastate tribal colleges and their students across America.
These proposed changes are extremely concerning because raising the full-time credit requirements and excluding less than part-time students would disproportionately harm TCUs. Part-time TCU power recipients see substantial increases in certificate and degree completion rates, and that's something that we're looking at that is across the board for TCUs.
Frank says TCUs offer nearly a $90 million economic impact to South Dakota alone when accounting for jobs, workforce development, and education. While contingencies do exist at Oglala Lakota College, Frank is concerned about the worst coming to pass with an associated loss of students.
Losing that would mean that everyone would have to take a step back. If we're not producing graduates to work in those positions, then I could see a lot of hardship to look at, coupling it with the financial necessity amid the rising inflation of an affordable child care. Transportation, especially in our rural areas, and the strain, we know, we already said that it would be almost cripple us or close us.
Frank is calling upon tribal leaders to advocate for their tribal colleges and universities to statewide D.C. delegations, and specifically asked South Dakota Representative Dusty Johnson and Senators John Thune and Mike Rounds to champion the issue. For National Native News, I'm C.J. Keene in Rapid City.
President Trump recently instructed the Interior Department to look into erasing negative references to the nation's past while embracing the beauty, abundance, and grandeur of the American landscape. But as KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, a Native group worries history will be erased.
Trump's executive order, which covers 500 million acres of federal land, is titled Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History.
From a tribal perspective, you could say, great, we're overdue for a little truth and sanity in American history, but of course we mean the opposite.
Valerie Grusing runs the nonprofit National Association of Tribal Historic Preservation Officers. The government is reviewing monuments and other markers that have been removed, renamed, or altered since 2020 for what it calls a false reconstruction of American history. But Grusing worries this mandate simply means whitewashing the past. The federal agency says the order isn't about erasing history, but meant to free narratives from ideological distortion. Any content deemed inappropriate shall be removed within 120 days. Gabriel Pietrazio, Phoenix.
The leader of the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma is expressing his concern over the closure of Job Corps training centers across the country. The Cherokee Nation says it was the first tribe to operate a Job Corps in 1978, and the program currently serves around 150 students. The federal government recently announced it was pausing the Job Corps program, which helps people ages 16 through 24 with career training. In a video message on social media this week, Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. shared an update saying the pause is an outright termination of the program, adding he opposes the closure and says the tribe is working to save the program.
Job Corps is often a career lifeline to students who may be struggling to find a path.
The tribe is suspending its Job Corps operations and preparing to send residential students home on June 13th. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Arctic Encounter 2025, an Arctic policy and business convening July 30th to August 1st that explores community resilience, critical infrastructure, and traditional knowledge. Early bird registration through June 15th at arcticencounter.com.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
More than double the oil flow through the pipeline and build the big, beautiful twin, the natural gas pipeline.
President Trump's cabinet officials tout the long-sought gas pipeline during a visit to the North Slope. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, June 4th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Senator Murkowski urges the Commerce Secretary to ensure systems that aid pilots and mariners are adequately staffed.
We need them to stay operational. So if you can just commit to me that you'll look at that.
Sounds sensible to me.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you love what you hear on your public radio station, consider becoming a member.
Make your impact at the University of Alaska Anchorage. UAA is a leading workforce provider offering you a path to the career you want, with over 100 academic programs for you to choose from, an array of in-person, online, and hybrid course options, and resources to help you succeed on your journey. UAA is what you're looking for. Apply today. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Three officials from the Trump administration visited the beginning of the Trans-Alaska oil pipeline on Monday with a gaggle of foreign nationals and business officials. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum, Energy Secretary Chris Wright, and EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin spoke to a crowd of oil workers at a gathering in Prudhoe Bay, where they celebrated the work underway to develop oil and gas in Alaska. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early was there and has this report.
Donning hard hats, bright safety vests, and goggles, dozens of North Slope oil workers gathered in freezing conditions to hear from a trio of high-level Trump administration officials. The event began with a prayer from Crawford Putkatuk, chairman of Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, and then a hymn.
Some of you guys might have heard it before. It says, it's a song, "Give me oil in my lamp, keep me burning." Remember that one? "Give me oil in my lamp, I pray."
Putkatuk used the song to illustrate how oil wealth has changed the lives of the Inupiat people in his community.
"All them years, our Eskimo people were singing, 'Give me oil in my land.' And the Lord is faithful." So we got a lot of oil under our feet. Thank God for that resource. And that resource has changed the lives of the Inupiat people from third world conditions.
Senator Dan Sullivan traveled with the Trump officials and said it's notable for so many cabinet level staff to be in the state for so long.
"This is the dream team, man. This is the best our country's had in terms of energy."
The group was there to promote Alaska's position as a source of petroleum for export and to focus on removing barriers to developing the state's energy resources. Specifically, they advocated for boosting oil flow down the Trans-Alaska pipeline and constructing a new pipeline to transport North Slope natural gas to markets overseas. The gas line would run parallel to the oil pipeline for much of its 807-mile route and would take natural gas from the North Slope to a port in Nikiski. Energy Secretary Wright says oil is the most used energy source on the planet, and natural gas is the fastest growing. He says President Trump wants to increase the production of both in Alaska.
"If we free Alaska and the people here, we're going to more than double the oil flow through the pipeline and build the big, beautiful twin, the natural gas pipeline from the North Slope."
It wasn't just American government officials on the tour. Foreign energy delegates from several Asian countries, including Japan, Taiwan, the Philippines, and South Korea, were visiting the pump station, with U.S. officials hoping the quality of the oil pipeline would encourage foreign support for the gas line. The challenge, as always, is finding the money. Building a gas line in Alaska has been the goal of state officials for decades, but the cost is currently estimated to be $44 billion. Wright says the Alaska Gas Export Project has an advantage compared to competing projects in other countries.
"You need to build a pipeline here that you don't for other natural gas projects.
The flip side is all of the gas production needed to completely fill that pipeline, it's already flowing from existing wells. It's just reinjected under the ground. So you don't need to develop a gas field to feed this pipeline. The gas already exists.
Interior Secretary Burgum deflected a question about whether the federal government might help fund the project. He said he thinks the state is in a better position to invest since it has a sovereign wealth fund, the Alaska Permanent Fund. All three officials cheered the president's goal of more energy production, with Burgum putting it in a global context.
It's the foundation of prosperity for our country. It's also the foundation of prosperity for our allies. And when we can have enough energy for ourselves and then sell energy to our friends and allies, they don't have to buy it from our adversaries.
While Trump officials touted oil and natural gas development in Alaska, they downplayed the potential for renewable energy. Recently, Interior officials paused more than $150 million for renewable projects in the state, including a wind energy project in Kotzebue. Burgum says those projects are currently under review.
One of the challenges, if you've got alternatives, wind and solar are intermittent. They're highly subsidized. They're not profitable, particularly wind. Doesn't seem to scale. Solar could over time.
The three Trump officials are also participating in Governor Mike Dunleavy's Sustainable Energy Conference, being held in Anchorage through Thursday. Reporting in Prudhoe Bay, I'm Wesley Early.
Staff reductions and budget cuts at the U.S. Commerce Department have Senator Lisa Murkowski concerned about Alaska's major industries. She told Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick at a Senate hearing today that Alaska pilots depend on the proper functioning of automated surface observing systems.
The ASOS systems, as they are known, which provide for the aviation safety, are managed by the National Weather Service. So right now, we're looking at about a 40% staffing shortage.
Murkowski urged Lutnick to look at the staffing levels in Alaska and make sure those systems are not compromised.
We need them to stay operational. So if you can just commit to me that you'll look at that.
Sounds sensible to me.
Murkowski also told Lutnick that Alaska's oil tankers depend on a different service of the Commerce Department, the National Data Buoy Center, which manages hundreds of buoys in Alaska, including a critical one in Prince William Sound.
The tankers can't leave Valdez unless they get the wave height information from the buoy, the weather buoy that's sitting out there, right? This buoy's been out of commission for months, and we're told it's due to funding for operation and maintenance in NOAA's budget.
It's really old.
It needs to be replaced.
Murkowski agreed with Lutnick on the need for an upgrade, but in the meantime, she told him the system needs to work so that safety is not compromised. She also said Alaska's seafood industry needs trade policies to counter Russian moves to dominate the market. Lutnick spoke at a Senate Appropriations Subcommittee to defend President Trump's 2026 budget request. A wildfire in northeastern British Columbia is disrupting traffic on the Alaska Highway. The progress of the Summit Lake wildfire has intermittently closed a 70-mile stretch of road west of Fort Nelson since it started burning last week. As of this afternoon, the highway had reopened to single-lane traffic, but that could change quickly depending on how the wildfire behaves, according to BC Wildfire Service. Cell service is limited in much of the burn area. The Wildfire Service urges travelers to prepare for delays and consider downloading the BC Wildfire app for updates on conditions. The fire has torched over 6,000 acres in the Northern Rockies since it started last week, and it's nowhere close to being contained, according to the fire service. About 50 firefighters are on the scene with helicopter support. The Wildfire Service suspects that lightning ignited the blaze, which has been accelerated by a multi-year drought. There are multiple other fires in the area, and the Wildfire Service expects to see them spread further with incoming windy weather. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, agencies work to reduce wildfire danger in Anchorage.
That's something that keeps me awake in my current role. And so the weight of that responsibility compelled me to do something.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It doesn't matter what you were wearing, what you were drinking, or what you agreed to in the past. Sexual assault is never your fault. Support is available 24/7 through multiple resources. Visit notaloneak.org to find help for yourself or a loved one. Remember, It's not your fault. This message sponsored by the Alaska Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
The Coast Guard is responding to a cargo ship that caught fire south of Adak yesterday. The crew was rescued with no injuries reported. All 22 crew members aboard the Morning Midas were evacuated onto a Good Samaritan vessel, the Malta-flagged Costco Hellas. The Coast Guard representative says the Morning Midas crew is expected to remain aboard the Costco Hellas as it continues toward its final destination in Panama. A Coast Guard cutter and aircraft crews responded to the distressed ship about 300 miles south of Adak yesterday afternoon and into today. Smoke was still coming from the vessel, but it was not clear what the fire status was today. The 600-foot Liberia-flagged Morning Midas was carrying thousands of vehicles to Mexico when the fire broke out. It's operated by London-based shipping company Zodiac Maritime. In a statement, Zodiac representatives say the Morning Midas crew started firefighting procedures immediately but could not get the fire under control. The company says it will work to salvage the vessel. A tugboat was deployed to support those efforts as well as firefighting needs. Company representatives say their priorities are to ensure crew safety and protect the marine environment. The Morning Midas is reported to be carrying more than 3,000 vehicles, some of which are hybrid or fully electric. Those vehicles have large batteries that can be dangerous when burned, as battery fires are hard to extinguish and come with risks of explosion and toxic fumes. A soldat, a man accused of being in the United States illegally, was detained by federal immigration officers last month, even though a federal judge had ordered he remain out of federal custody in his deportation case just weeks before. As KDLL's Ashlyn O'Hara reports, court documents say the well-known business owner is currently detained at a federal facility in Washington.
Francisco Rodriguez Rincon's lawyer, Samuel Eilers, says the federal government cannot deport his client and charge him with federal crimes at the same time. Eilers is a federal public defender representing the 47-year-old owner and operator of Señor Pancho's and Sol Agave Mexican restaurants in Soldotna. In March, a federal grand jury charged Rodriguez Rincon with illegally re-entering the United States after being deported and making a false statement of citizenship when he applied for an Alaska driver's license. Rodriguez Rincon pleaded not guilty to those charges in April. At his arraignment hearing, a federal judge ordered his continued release. But Eilers says federal immigration authorities took Rodriguez Rincon into custody in Soldotna about 3 weeks later, while Eilers was on leave. As of Wednesday morning, court documents say Rodriguez Rincon is being held at the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement's Processing Center in Tacoma, Washington. In his motion, Eilers characterizes Rodriguez Rincon's detention as, quote, unforeseen and confounding. He says it violates the Federal Bail Reform Act and his client's constitutional rights. Rodriguez Rincon's detention prompted confusion among Soldotna residents who had tried to visit his popular Mexican restaurants late last month. A handwritten sign hung on the door at Señor Pancho's said the business was closed permanently. Last month, the director of Alaska's Business Licensing Division told KDLL state law doesn't require people to demonstrate U.S. citizenship to obtain an Alaska business license. On Wednesday, an ICE spokesperson declined to answer specific questions about Rodriguez Rincon's detention or case. In an emailed statement, the spokesperson said it's routine for ICE to arrest people who break immigration laws. Eiler's motion says Rodriguez Rincon has never been convicted of a crime. A GoFundMe organized for Rodriguez Rincon's family had raised more than $3,200 as of Wednesday around noon. The fundraiser says Rodriguez Rincon has a wife and four kids in Soldotna. Eilers is asking for expedited consideration of his motion for the federal government to release Rodriguez Rincon or drop the federal charges against him. Rodriguez Rincon is next scheduled to appear in court on June 10th in Anchorage. He had previously waived his right to appear in court in person. But also on Wednesday, Eilers filed a separate motion revoking that waiver and asserting Rodriguez Rincon's right to appear at court hearings in person. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Ashlyn O'Hara.
Anchorage has a huge amount of urban wildlands, which puts the city at risk of wildfires. This summer, multiple agencies are collaborating on a massive effort to try to protect the municipality. As Alaska Public Media's Hannah Floor reports, that means burning brush and a lot of cutting down trees.
All over the Anchorage hillside, firefighters are burning piles of spruce branches. Ethan DeBush is with the State Division of Forestry and Fire Prevention. He's in charge of reducing burnables in wild areas.
It's actually a bit of an art and a science.
When it comes to wildfire mitigation, there are specific ways to do pretty much everything, like making sure a prescribed burn is fully out. They stick their bare hands into the remains of a fire.
If a firefighter can't keep their hand in there for around 5 seconds, it's too hot to abandon and they'll keep putting it out.
It's been a long time since anyone's come in to trim spruce branches and burn underbrush. Doug Schrage is chief of the Anchorage Fire Department. He says nearly two decades ago, budget cuts got in the way of wildfire planning, and not much has been done since. But that all changed last year. The department used federal grant money to hire people focused on wildfire mitigation. And they started a collaboration between a whole bunch of local and state agencies. They're working together to reduce wildfire risk in the city by clearing trees and underbrush and turning them into mulch, and by holding town halls and public education campaigns. They're sharing resources and responsibilities. Schrage says it feels like a new era.
It's really becoming a bit of a community effort in that way, and I love it.
He says there's still a lot to do, but the city is more prepared than it has been in a long time. And he says wildfires in California and Hawaii have shown just how necessary that preparation is. Those fires killed dozens over the past few years and displaced thousands. They destroyed swaths of city, even whole towns. Schrage says he wants to know he's done everything in his power to prevent that from happening here.
That's something that keeps me awake in my current role. And so the weight of that responsibility compelled me to do something.
At a town hall in May, with reps from about a dozen agencies in attendance, Schrage told folks that the threat of wildfires in the area is very real. He said there have been a few close calls in recent years. And while this year's risk level is about average, average isn't great. Climate change is complicating that risk. That's according to Norm McDonald. He's with the State Division of Forestry and Fire Protection. He said all of Alaska is seeing longer, warmer, and drier conditions.
As a kid who grew up in Alaska, I can tell you firsthand of the snow and the cold winters we had compared to what we're seeing now. And I think a lot of you, if you're lifetime Alaskans, have witnessed that firsthand as well.
It's also complicated by where people are building new homes.
People want to live off the road or out of the communities. They want to have their slice of Alaska, which we all understand.
Saving human life is the number one priority, so a lot of work goes into making sure those wooded residential areas are protected, like Anchorage's hillside. There are more than a dozen ongoing or planned projects in the municipality using various approaches to fire management. Take the Campbell Airstrip Road. It's the only way in and out for a community of about 250 homes. The municipality is working on a 3-mile-long fire break with nearly 150 feet of land on either side of the road. There's no underbrush and very few trees. The idea is the lack of fuel would slow fires, making it possible to evacuate residents. Also on their list are a bunch of smaller fire breaks all over the municipality. Those still need approval, and some still need funding. Back on the hillside, firefighters are sawing lower limbs off spruce trees. Ethan DeBush says that's to make it less likely fire will climb up the branches and into the canopy, where it's harder to put out. He says even with all the noise and smoke, folks in the neighborhood have been supportive.
We've even had some homemade pies delivered to the crew who was camping.
They were apple pies, but DeBush didn't get any. It was his day off. He says his crew did make sure to tell him just how delicious they were, though. In Anchorage, I'm Hannah Floor.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
GCI, keeping schools and students connected across the state with a resilient and redundant network. Details at gci.com/education.
Make your impact at the University of Alaska Anchorage. UAA is a leading workforce provider offering you a path to the career you want, with over 100 academic programs for you to choose from, an array of in-person, online, and hybrid course options, and resources to help you succeed on your journey. UAA is what you're looking for. Apply today. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Public media is about you, the community we serve. Thank you for tuning in.
National Park Service rangers recovered the body of a ski mountaineer today who fell 3,000 feet to his death off the west buttress of Denali. The agency identified the victim as 41-year-old Alex Chu of Seattle. Denali National Park and Preserve spokesperson Amber Smeagol said it's likely that Chu died after he slipped from a ledge on Denali's west buttress and fell onto the rocky face of the Peters Glacier.
His body was found at the bottom of the 3,000-foot slope of the glacier.
Chu was one of three ski mountaineers who set out on an expedition Monday to ascend the peak, which was recently named Mount McKinley by President Trump. When the mountaineers reached the 12,000-foot level, two of them saw Chu fall at a spot along the icy and steep portion of the route called Squirrel Point. Smeagol said the incident occurred while Chu was descending, but she said park officials are not sure where they were headed.
We still don't know whether or not they were attempting to summit, whether they did summit. All that we know was that he was on his descent.
Smeagol said the two other mountaineers were planning to fly out of Base Camp 1 today. She said an investigation into the incident is ongoing. Understanding how sea ice breaks up in the spring can mean life or death for Northwest Arctic residents who use it for travel. As KOTZ's Desiree Hagen reports, a new study using specialized technology and local knowledge hopes to better predict how and when ice will break apart.
Every year, there's a reoccurring weak spot on the ice around Kotzebue in an area known as Kobuk Lake. It's well known by locals, but its cause hasn't been clear. Zhashu Zhang is trying to fill in the gaps.
Many community members noticed this crack, and it seems to be coming up year after year. And they don't really understand why it forms in this particular way.
Zhang is a co-lead on a project surveying sea ice from the air. She's still working on an answer for why the crack develops, but has a working theory that has to do with where the ice forms at the beginning of the season. Beyond that one weak spot, she says that the research is important for developing models that will help both locals and the Arctic as a whole.
This is a very new type of model which simulates each piece of the ice flow, like little polygons moving around. So when I first saw that model, I said, oh, this is really cool. It can be really useful for coastal communities.
The project is called Arctic Air. The AIR stands for Airborne Investigations and Research. Zhang's team uses aircraft to conduct a variety of surveys, from looking at ocean color to determine potential algal blooms to measuring sea ice using specialized cameras.
What we want to do is to combine observation, modeling capabilities, and also indigenous knowledge, and try to develop a new ice model that can help predict the ice breakup timing.
Zhang's team conducted the surveys in a twin otter plane owned by NOAA with nearly a dozen pieces of specialized equipment in a customizable bay in the aircraft's floor. One of the team's specialized tools is a hyperspectral camera, which can capture a range of data, less like a photograph and more like a block of images, with information undetectable to the human eye.
Like, for example, if you look at something by your eye, you're looking at the visible band, and it's just like one picture of that thing. But for a hyperspectral camera, what it looks like, it's like a whole spectrum, like at visible and near infrared.
Zhang says the ideal time for researchers to monitor the ice is when it's moving around, and that they have to plan the trip several months in advance. This year they arrived in mid-May. That was a little early for breakup, which started later than normal.
We were looking back the past 25 years. So this year is like relatively late, and it has been pretty late in the past 2-3 years in a row.
Still, Zhang says her team was able to get information about ice features and terrain, which can help improve their models for when they return next year. They also worked with several community members who shared their observations about weather and ice conditions. Zhang Liu is a research scientist on the project. He says he hopes the project will include more input from the local community, like measurements of ice when people are out ice fishing.
Because the purpose of this research is to provide some sea ice breakup forecast for the community, so it makes people safer to fish, to hunt over the ice. We really appreciate the community members can provide some in-situ data for us, like taking the ice thickness and measure the ocean sea condition.
The researchers say they hope to be back next year to collect more data that can inform both locals and the scientific community about how, when, and where the ice will break. In Kotzebue, I'm Desiree Hagen.
The City of Hoonah and Hoonah Heritage Foundation unveiled a brand new 21-foot totem pole during a ceremony at the Hoonah Harbor last week. The totem pole, called a kutia in Lingit, was designed and raised to honor the community's rich fishing history and traditions. KTOO's Clarice Larson was there and has this story.
It's called the Fisherman's Honor Totem Pole. Carved into the yellow cedar log are depictions of different fishing methods that locals use.
You have the gill netter, and then you have the rod and reeler. All by
Master hand. Artist Gordon Greenwald describes the design of the brand new totem pole that now stands at Hoonah's Harbor. He speaks through a microphone to a crowd of more than 100 people who gathered for the ceremony.
So this is what you're looking at. The Hoonah fishing people. All of us in the past, all of us in the future, and all of us now.
Many Hoonah residents attended the event, and a catamaran brought dozens of people from Juneau for the ceremony. Fishing is deeply intertwined with the economy and identity of Hoonah. During the 1950s and 60s, Hoonah became known as the home of the million-dollar fleet. That's because of the local fishermen's highly lucrative skills and success on the water. Hoonah's Vice Mayor Amelia Wilson thanked the crowd for celebrating the kutia and the meaning behind it.
And to see so many of our fishermen and fisherwomen here really just makes me so proud to be honoring all of you and that legacy that we have of thousands and thousands of years of amazing fishermen.
David Shakely, a speaker at the event, says the pole honors the fishermen who are alive today and recognizes those who have passed away. He references the rain, which patters down on the tents above the crowd. Many people present were active or retired fishermen.
This kutia is here to help turn those tears of sorrow into tears of joy, to continue on the fishing that is so important within the community, to continue that on into the future.
The ceremony included traditional songs and dance as the tarp was pulled away from the pole to unveil it to the community. In Hoonah, I'm Clarice Larson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Shelby Herbert in Fairbanks, Wesley Early in Prudhoe Bay, Andy Luskin in Alaska, Ashlyn O'Hara and Hannah Floor in Anchorage, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Desiree Hagen in Kotzebue, and Clarice Larson in Hoonah. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Don't wait 24 hours to report a missing person. As soon as you suspect someone is missing, call your local law enforcement or 911 to make a report. Be ready to provide as much descriptive information as possible to help locate your friend, family member, or loved one. Your reporting can make all the difference, and maybe even save a life. Learn more about Alaska's Village Public Safety Officers at vpso.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Village Public Safety Officer Program.
Talk to you, but it's not the same.
here by my side is all that I can do. My arms around my pillow at night, it should be holding you. Thank you.
accidents. Cherry flavored antacids. Sit and drink in a royal tea. Still life that's inside of
Trees are